for about 5,000, 6,000 years, dating back to Solomon in the Old Testament, there have been people who have philosophized about what alcoholism is, what gluttony is. Gluttony, if you really look at a good dictionary, is what we are. Independently of Roseanne forming OA, there was a group in Luling, Texas that was formed that was GA, Gluttons Anonymous, by a guy by the name of A.G. Ainsworth, who I had the pleasure of meeting, and he was a very instrumental character in the development of Overeaters Anonymous, and he believed that the name should be Gluttons Anonymous, but there was 11 groups of OA and 5 groups of GA, and the vote was 11-5 on the name. And along with a lady by the name of Norma B., they formed in Luling, Texas, GA. But for a long, long time, this has been philosophized about and studied. Solomon believed that alcoholism was an illness. He had no cure for it. He couldn't prove it was an illness. And so it was just a theory. In England, in about the 1640s, there was a guy, and his name was Dr. Trotter. Dr. Trotter was a man who was a physician, and he believed, after observation, that alcoholism was an illness. He did not have a cure for it, nor did he. Could he prove it? Couldn't prove it. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was a guy by the name of Dr. Benjamin Rush, and he became the first Surgeon General of the United States. Benjamin Rush is the namesake for a street in my city, Chicago, that if you visit my city, Chicago, I'm from Chicago, as you know, you'll undoubtedly want to see some of the things in and around a place called Rush Street, and that's named after him. And Benjamin Rush believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. There was a guy who lived in Pennsylvania here in the United States in around the 1850s. And he believed that he had developed a cracker. He had developed a wafer. And he believed that because he loaded this with enough B12, that he had a cure for alcoholism. He didn't know that alcoholism was an illness. He believed that it was a condition of low spirituality, low character, low willpower, and he believed that he could develop a cracker that was packed with so much B12 that if people ate this cracker that they wouldn't masturbate and they wouldn't drink alcohol. And his name was Dr. Graham, and Graham developed his famous cracker, and Dr. Graham was a Quaker, and that's what he believed, that this cracker would cure people. And that's where you get Graham crackers today, but they're very different. Today they're almost a cookie. They're nothing like what he had developed. But he believed that people should stop masturbating and stop drinking, and that if they would eat his crackers, they would do so. In the 1920s, there was a man in New York City who was a neurologist, and he was not concerned with alcoholism at all. His name was Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. And on October the 29th, 1929, William Duncan Silkworth lost everything he had that was tied up in the stock market, and he lost his portfolio, and he went to his friend Charlie Towns. And Charlie Towns was the owner and physician at what was at that time of the late 20s, early 30s, the preeminent hospital in the United States for the treatment of drug addiction and alcoholism. And it is called the Towns Hospital. And in 1929, Dr. Silkworth went to work there, and he observed over time that there were people who came in as alcoholics. Now, primarily these were men. There were some women, but primarily they were men. and they would come into the hospital, and he would load them up with B12, although he didn't expect them to stop masturbating, but he would load them up with B12, and he would load them up with medicine, and load them up with food, and he would take care of them, and he noticed that some of these men would go on their merry way and never come back. But there was a group, there was an entity of these people who seemed that no matter what he did in terms of its replication of what he did with these other people, that these select people, these drunks over here, would go out of the hospital and come back sometimes that very day, sometimes within a few days, sometimes within a week, in worse shape than they had gone out of the hospital. And he noticed that some of these people came in and went out and came in and went out and came in and went out as if the hospital had a revolving door. And some of these people came in and left and they were done. And he started to notice, he started to formulate some observations about these drunks over here as opposed to those drinkers over there. And he started to formulate an opinion that was not the prevailing medical opinion at the time, because for the thousands and thousands of years leading up to him, this was described and believed as lack of character. It was described and believed as a form of weak will. It was believed to be a lack of strength and lack of character that needed an infusion of religion or somehow some willpower, and they would put alcoholics in insane asylums, and they would give them frontal lobotomies, and they would cut into them, and they would condemn them. Very, very, very hopeless group of people, these alcoholics. Very famous painting, if you've never seen it. It's about a doctor, and he's looking, it's a French, I'm not much on art, but this is something that caught my eye. It's a French painting, and the guy is looking at his patients, and they are looking at him with eyes through these caskets. And they're looking through the caskets, and he's a doctor, and he's got this hopeless look on his face. And it says, Dr. Moreau and his drunks. Because there was nothing he could do for them, and we're going to talk about that tonight before we go to sleep. Let's take a look at the doctor's opinion and how it changed the world, and we're going to talk more tomorrow for what we're going to start doing tonight. So I know some of you, I can see some of you are kind of falling asleep. Understand that this material that we're going to go over tonight, this doctor's opinion, is the foundation, is the trust, is the absolute foundation of everything that we're going to build on, not just this weekend, but as you move forward in your program of recovery. Because without that inner concept of what this is, we are lost. We have to conceive of what he's going to tell us. Let's take a look together at what Dr. Silkworth writes. He was asked to write this. He told Bill Wilson, the book was written 37-38. Bill says, will you write this for us? He says, yes. He says, but don't you put my name in this thing now. He says, you're going to get me thrown out of the damn medical profession because his theories were not accepted. Now, what happened was, it used to be no Dr. William B. Silkworth. If you look at a first edition, it says blank, blank, MD. Well, in 1949, what happened? The American Medical Association started accepting alcoholism as an illness, and he told Bill Wilson, he says, okay, you can put my name in there now. So here you have Silkworth, but in the first 14 printings, I think it is, or 12 printings of the first edition, it says blank, blank, MD, and now you have William Silkworth. Let's see where we go. Okay, we have alcoholics. Hold on one second here. Just got to get a little. Okay, all right. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. a well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. That hospital is the Towns Hospital in New York City, and this is what he says. I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. If you're not hopeless, you're not going to do the work. If you don't crawl in here on your stomach, you're wasting our time. You're wasting our time. Do you know what Dutch doors are? Dutch doors are detached. There's a top and a bottom. Every meeting should have the top nailed shut. Because if you don't crawl in through the bottom, you're not going to do this work. Why? Because your ego is going to tell you you have ideas on how you're going to do this yourself, your way, on your terms. Hopeless is a good place to be. Out of ideas. First thing I ask my people that I sponsor, are you willing to go to any length? Are you out of ideas on how you're going to do this yourself? Okay. In the course of his third treatment, and in Bill's story tomorrow morning, we're going to learn that Bill will be hospitalized for his alcoholism three times. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. That's the Oxford group steps that we're going to be talking about. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. He's talking about the first 100. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. If Weight Watchers worked, if TOPS worked, if Nutrisystems worked, if the Pay and Ways worked, if the surgeries worked, if the pills worked, if the massages worked, if the chiropractors worked, if the psychiatrists worked, you wouldn't be sitting here. You wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't know you. I would assume you wouldn't be sitting in this room right now at the OA retreat. And so other methods failed completely, but once again, they didn't fail if they led you here. They only fail if you get here and don't do the damn work. If you come here now that you know that this works and you still don't do the work, there's not much we can do for you. And so on Sunday, before I turn you back into the world, I'm going to ask each and every one of you not to go tell people how what this was or what we talked about. Show them. Dr. Bob said at the end of his life, carry a message. And if you must, use words. Okay, we're going to be talking about that Sunday. We're going to cry, we're going to laugh, we're going to hug, then we're going to go out and we're going to eat Twinkies. No, then we're not going to. Okay. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type without... I can't even talk, with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth. William Silkworth died in 1951. But what he laid down for us has saved tens of millions of lives. He is a part of the tapestry of why we're here. He is a part of the tapestry that has become AA. He is a part of the tapestry that has become every 12-step program that followed, and we're going to talk about why here in just a second. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement he confirms what we have suffered what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. This is groundbreaking information about the physical aspect. And we are going to talk about a word in the next paragraph that through me, and I bet that there are people sitting in this room that really are in the same boat. We're going to talk about allergy. We're going to talk about the word allergy. And when I came in here, people said to me, don't eat Raisinets. You're allergic to Raisinets. And I'd say, I'm eating 4 bathtubs full of Raisinets every day. I'm not sneezing. I'm not itching. I may be breaking out in massive quantities of blubber, but I'm not sneezing and I don't have watery eyes and I'm not Oh, no. They said, no, you're just allergic. You can't eat it. And they didn't understand it any better than I did. And then what I did was I went to a source of information that never seems to fail me. I looked it up in the dictionary. I looked up the word allergy, and it said an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. Adverse, an abnormal reaction to the food, beverage, or substance. Now, wait a minute, I thought to myself. When I eat food, there is something very adverse and abnormal about what happens to me. A normal eater, and you know them, you have them in your life. Normal, everyday eaters, when they sit down to eat a meal, they get all the food they want every time they sit down. In my body, when that food hits my system, the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat. And it's just endless. They get all the food they want every time they sit down to a meal. They're the type of people that say stupid, idiotic things like, who could eat so much food? Or, oh, it's too sweet. Oh, it's too rich. And you want to test weapons on them or something. And in my body, the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat. And it's just endless. So I want the 87th Oreo cookie with more ferocious energy than I wanted the second one or the first one. Because the more I want, the more I eat. The more I eat, the more I want. And it's endless. They have the same relationship with food that I have with the gasoline in my automobile. I take my automobile to the gas station. I fill my car up with gas. I go about my merry way. And I don't sit and obsess about gasoline that night. I don't sneak off to a gas station in a strange neighborhood where they don't know me and pretend I'm having a gasoline party that there's 80 people and I want to know, will this tank feed them all? I don't lie about gasoline. I don't have shame and guilt and remorse tied into you seeing me buying gasoline at my local station. But I do have shame and guilt and remorse tied into, and that's more of a mental thing, obviously, but I don't go off in the middle of the night to sneak another quart in the tank when no one's looking, because I don't feel the need to do that, and they don't feel the need either. And that's why I could never understand, and they could never understand, and we're going to talk about the effect soon, why I ate as much as I did, and I could never understand why they didn't. What strength, what pillar of power were they tapped into that I just couldn't pray at, or I couldn't tap into? What made them so strong? What made them so smart? What made them so molecularly different than me that they had the power to look at a plate of cake or cookies or whatever and just for they don't even see it? What is it that they possess that I just cannot seem to tap into? And now I have an understanding that they don't react the way I do, mentally or physically. Let's get to some of the nuts and bolt details and let's pull that apart so that it will make more sense. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Look at your own life. Why would you stand in front of the refrigerator with the damn light in your face, getting a suntan from the light, looking for something in there to make you feel better because you're sick to your stomach and you just puked or you just had diarrhea from eating so much and now you're looking for more food to make you feel better? That's insane. And you've done it. You've done that. You stood there in clothes that didn't fit, crying your eyes out because you couldn't do the thing you wanted to do or go the place that you wanted to go and look the way you wanted to look and be the person that you wanted to be. And you wanted to be that person and you wanted to look the way you wanted to look. And something almost magnetic, something almost subterranean, insane, sucked you in and you told yourself bullshit that you'll eat the rest of the cake tonight so that there's none in the house and tomorrow you'll get back on your diet. That tonight you'll eat the halava, you'll eat the cake, you'll eat the cookies, you'll eat the egg rolls, you'll eat the pizza so that they're not in the house tomorrow and damn it, tomorrow you're going to stay on your diet. Come on. Come on. Let's find out why. I promise I'll have you out of here at a decent time. Okay. I get off on sidetracks. Okay. Uh-oh. Janice? Okay, sorry. Though we work out, I need somebody to hold me to where I'm at, and George is not here. If you've listened to my tapes, George W. in Los Angeles, I don't go on without George. George always knows where I'm at. So, okay. Though we work out our, and Linda does it in Scottsdale. Okay. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is still jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. The doctor writes, this is the second of three letters, the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance, watch out here, to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now, I'm going to read this next paragraph twice. I'm going to read it as it's written, and then I'm going to read it again because I want the definition in this paragraph to jump out at you in the most simplistic way I know how, and this may be my ego talking, but I think this will help. Tell me if it does. Now, I'm going to read it the way it is. Now, remember, he's a doctor. He's not one of us. He's a doctor. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Now I'm going to read it again. Tell me if it helps. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond medicine's conception. What with medicine's ultra-modern standards, medicine's scientific approach to everything, doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our synthetic, our medical knowledge. What's he telling you here? We know what's wrong with you. We get it. Somebody mark my place in your mind. We know what's wrong with you. We get what's wrong with you. There is nothing we can do for you. We are as powerless over your illness as you are. We can't give you medicine. We can't make you stand on your head. We can't make you jump up and down. There's nothing we can do for you. We would love to help you. We have dumped a boatload of dreck on the doorstep of doctors and said, cure us. They can't. They can load you up with pills. They can operate on you. They can analyze you. They can't cure you. That has to come from a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And by the time you go back to your life, I want to do everything I can do to explain to you how that keeps you out of the food, how that works, and why we need to do it. And to get in between you and the food must come a spiritual awakening as the result of working the steps. Help. Many years ago, right? Somebody, please? Okay. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive in their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power. Now watch your capitalizations here. Power is capital, that's God, in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. And what that means is a spiritual awakening will not take place if you're still eating. Go across to an AA meeting and ask those guys if they're still drinking, will they have a spiritual awakening? And they'll tell you no. Put down the food. Put down the food. I know that it's tough, especially at first when you're dieting. You haven't had a spiritual awakening. You're just beginning. If you continue to eat allergy-creating foods where you're setting yourself up with that craving, if you are continuing to consume food in an alcoholic way, you will not have a spiritual awakening. Why not, you ask? Because you will not get in touch with the feelings that are going on. When people would say to me, don't eat so much, you'll feel better, they were right. When I don't eat so much, when I'm dieting down on unaided willpower, oh, do I feel better. I feel anger better, I feel fear better, I feel crushes on girls better, I feel lots of things better. And as those feelings would burst to the surface inside my heart, inside my soul, my brain would lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that would come at once by eating the food. I would eat the food, trigger the allergy, pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to eat that way again, and I would repeat that cycle over and over and over and over and over again. The mind telling me it's okay and the body ensuring that it's not. But what I'm going to talk about in the rest of this and for the rest of the weekend is, what if I could find a way to live where my mind doesn't lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food? What if I could find a way to live where I don't want the food, I don't think about the food, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion? And that process of bringing God into my heart and into my life through the steps, so that I don't want the food, because my selfishness, self-seeking, fear, anger, and dishonesty do not build to the level where my brain, my mental twist, will lock in on that sense of ease and comfort and call out irresistibly for the food. My brain doesn't get to that level, and that process is called recovery. That's what we're about, and that's what we're doing. You see, boys and girls, it's not that I haven't compulsively overeaten in 13 years. I don't want to. I don't fight food. If you're in here and you're awake still and you're fighting food, some of you are still awake, I see you. Okay. Now, if you're in here and you're fighting food and you get to the end of the day with a list of what you didn't eat, and a list of what you're not going to eat tomorrow, and you're fighting food and fighting food and fighting food, come and join Overeaters Anonymous. I invite you to join our program. I invite you to understand that you're not alone. There are people out there that are the blind leading the blind. And that's all they know is this dieting. And so, and there's non-compulsive overeaters that are sponsors with thin bodies in OA too. That happens too. And I've seen it. And they're passing on their dieting tips, and you may be in there thinking, why the f*** isn't this working for me? I'm still fighting the food. Come on and join OA. Come on and be one of us. Don't fight the food. Work the steps. I'm going to take you through them this weekend. We're going to pull them apart. We're going to demystify them together. We're going to smash the myth that this is somehow difficult, and we're going to lay it out in the simplest, most basic way possible. Where does it begin? It begins with putting the food down. And this is what he's telling you here. If you're still eating, it's not going to happen, boys and girls. It's not going to happen. Okay, help somebody. Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. I couldn't see the trees. The forest was in the way. Okay. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, thanks by the way, and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. There's that word again. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average, excuse me, thank you, temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit, found they cannot break it. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Wow. Their reliance upon things human, they lose their self-confidence. Who wouldn't lose self-confidence? Everything I tried failed. I woke some of you up. See, I love yelling when it gets late like this, because some of you, what? What the hell is he talking about? Okay, so, of course I lose self-confidence. I have all F's on my report card. Every single thing I tried, thank you, in this world to stop doing this was an utter failure. I went to the doctor. I took the pills. I ate when they wore off. I read the magazines with the diets. I read the books. I walked from here to the moon. I did everything I was supposed to do. And I couldn't stop wanting the food. I couldn't stop wanting the food. And people would say, don't eat so much, you'll feel better. Oh, as I said 5 minutes ago, they were right. Oh, I felt anger better. I felt fear better. I felt jealousy better. Crushes on girls better. I felt lots of things better. But one thing I never felt was like not eating. I never felt like not eating. You know how funny that is? You know, when they lose a little weight, they feel really good and they're really happy they're not eating. And when I lose a little weight, all I want them to do is go right to hell so I can eat and get them away from me. Because when I lose a little bit of weight, when I'm not eating, I'm restless, irritable, and discontented. We're going to talk about that. Because when I'm not eating, I'm miserable. And the only thing I know to do is eat. Because of something called the effect. Let's look at what he says. Somebody help. Oh, frothy emotional, is that? Okay. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. What does that mean? It means people nagging you won't help. The world nagging you won't help. You've lost out on the promotion. You've trained people that became your boss. You've seen the world pass you by professionally and personally, and your weight was holding you back. A normal, sane person loses weight. You kept eating even more. And as you got older, it became harder to take off. And the effects became worse and worse. And the cravings became harder and harder. And the result of what the food was doing to you became worse and worse. We're going to be talking about that this weekend, too. The message which can interest. I know where I'm going. I just forget. I lose. Okay. The message. I'm not senile. I'm just confused. Okay. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. What does that mean? That means that you speak the language of the heart. That you can speak the melody of the soul. You have the depth and the weight. And the hell that you went through to get here. And the physical beatings that some of you took to get here. And the rapes that some of you endured to get here. And the molestations that you endured to get here. And the humiliation of what you endured to get here. And the story that is uniquely yours, will be quiet, that is uniquely yours that got you here will save the lives of other people. Because we're not going to waste your tears. We're not going to waste your broken heart. We're not going to waste your loneliness. We're going to use it as fertilizer to grow a soul that can recover and flourish. And through that will become your greatest joy. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't stop. The shore is right. Keep going. Don't stop. It's coming. It's there. Are you not there yet? Come on. Work the steps. The message must have depth and weight. And that means that you are charged with carrying this message to broken, scared, hurting people who are coming into your meetings, who are beat down. Who are beat down. They have been humiliated by a world that doesn't understand them. They have been abandoned. I have been in meetings, I don't know that you have, I have been in meetings many times with girls that have had the crap beat out of them by idiotic people who beat them because they were getting too fat after their marriages. I have been in meetings with men who have had their wives divorce them, leave them, abandon them because they were gaining weight. I have had people whose children turned their back on them. I'll tell you that story maybe at breakfast tomorrow. I have had people whose children turned against them, whose parents turned against them, who have been fired, who have been demoted at their jobs because of their obese condition. They have been deemed and branded as unacceptable by the world that they were born into. And why? What was their crime? Because they can't stop eating in the face of every reason to do so. And so when that message must have depth and weight, God is going to send you. God is going to choose you. God is going to bring people into your life. You don't know what to say to them. We're going to talk about this Sunday again, but I repeat myself quite a bit. Not as much as I did when I was on speed. But but what I'm going to say is this. You can come into their life. And you can light them up. You can bring them something that Weight Watchers cannot bring them, that TOPS cannot bring them, that Nutrisystem cannot bring them, that the psychiatrist and the psychologist cannot bring them. You can light them up.
You can give them hope that maybe, just maybe, if you went through the hell you went through, and you're here, and you look great, and you're recovering, that maybe you can send them home from their first meeting that they were scared to death to go to with a smile on their face, and maybe for the first time in their life, the knowledge that says, maybe I met you, maybe I saw you, and I found out that your husband divorced you too because you were fat. And maybe you can send them home with the hope that if she can make it, maybe I can too. Maybe if I do what she did, or what you did, or what you did, or you, or you, or you, that maybe I can recover too. Maybe I too can be one of you. Because Lord only knows there has been no place for these to go up until that day. There has been nowhere that said to those people, me too, me too. So don't take that job lightly. To the world, you're a person. To that person, you can be the world. You can light them up and you can give them hope. And pills can't give you hope. And psychiatrists and psychologists and nutritionists and Weight Watchers and all the can't give them the hope that you give them by that depth and that weight. You speak the language of the heart. Speak it and understand the melody of the soul that these people are hurting. These people are dying. Okay, I promised to try to rein myself in there. Okay, help.
In nearly all cases.
Okay, keep reading.
In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves. It's right before the apostrophe.
Okay, keep going.
If they are to recreate their lives.
I'm not lost, I'm just out of breath.
Oh, okay. If they feel that as a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them.
Just the first sentence, then I'm going to stop you. Go on. Men and women.
Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol.
One more sentence.
The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false.
Okay, stop. We're talking about the effect. We have been talking all of our lives prior to OA about what the food was doing to you. People pointed out what the food was doing to you. You saw what the food was doing to you, and you wondered why you ate it. You wondered how they didn't. Here's what the food was doing for you, and it is something that only you feel. The food was giving you an effect. It says here, the sensation is so elusive. While they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. What is he talking about there? It feels good for about 7 seconds, 8 seconds to eat the cake. And it feels so good that I cannot tell myself the difference between the lies and the truth. And we're going to talk about that. What's the first victim of compulsive behavior? What's the first victim of addiction? It's the truth. We're going to talk about that more tomorrow in Bill's story. The first thing to go out the window when addiction is practiced, the truth. Right out the window. The effect of what the food is doing for me feels great. They don't feel what it does for me. Now, I'm born and raised in Chicago, where the Shedd Aquarium is. I'm born and raised there, and I love the taste. If you go out, not now, it's only June, but in the end of August, September, October, you go out into the country in Illinois, you can buy apples and tomatoes and corn and all these various places have roadside stands in Chicago where you can get the most delicious farm fresh produce.
They also have places in Chicago like Sara Lee Bakeries. Mm-hmm. Now, I went steady with Sara Lee all through high school, and then I broke up with her for a little bit in college and went out with a girl named Little Debbie. But there's also places in Chicago called Amy Joy. It's a donut place, much like Dunkin' Donuts out here. And we have lots and lots of places. Do you know something? I love the taste of tomatoes and lettuce and all that. I've never gone out in the middle of the night and spent money I didn't have and write bad checks for corn and peas and tomatoes and lettuce. Unless they were on a Whopper, I really didn't consume those things in the voracious amounts. But I have done that for Raisinets and McDonald's fries and cheeseburgers and milkshakes. Why? Because those foods created something in me that the tomatoes and the lettuce didn't create unless they were on a Whopper. And that's the effect. For about 9 seconds after I eat McDonald's fries, feels good. Feels real good. And then about 10 seconds go by and I'm shoveling it in my mouth. Because unfortunately, I've triggered the physical allergy. And once I've triggered the physical allergy, I can no longer control the amount that I eat. I eat the food, I trigger the allergy, pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat that way again. The food is doing something for me that it does not do for the normal eater. You can't see our allergy. You can only feel it, and only a compulsive overeater feels it. So there's something that the food does for you. Now, what we're going to do, boys and girls, we're going to work steps. We're going to bring God into this equation of my brain being scared, angry, selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and my brain is locking in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food. And the brain doesn't tell me that when I eat one piece of pizza, I'll eat the whole pizza and humiliate myself. It says we can't differentiate the true from the false. My brain says, this time, we're just going to eat one piece of pizza, right? My brain says, this time we're just going to eat some of the Oreos and we'll save the rest for tomorrow. My brain says, we're just going to eat a couple of those cupcakes. I eat a couple of cupcakes and then I eat them all. I eat a couple of Oreos and I eat them all. I eat a piece of the pizza and I eat it all because of the physical allergy. What I'm going to do by bringing God into the equation is, my brain is going to not feel so good because of my defects of character. My brain is going to lock in on the food. I'm going to stick God in between the brain wanting the food and the eating of the food, and I'm going to circumvent temporarily the destructive nature of the mental obsession, of the mental twist. I'm going to bring God into the equation so that I already feel better. I don't need to lock in on that sense of ease and comfort. I'm operating on honesty because I'm operating on clarity. I'm operating on honesty because I'm operating on clarity. I am working the steps, neutralizing the effect of selfishness, neutralizing the effect of fear and anger. I'm bringing God in, casting out the thought of the food. I'm working the steps. The mental obsession is like the siren calling the sailors to the rocks, and they dash their ship every time because those sirens look so desirable, they dash their ship on the rocks. Everybody know what I'm talking about? Okay. I see the sirens on the beach. I wave at them as we sail by safely. They can't get me to the rocks because I brought God into the equation and I'm no longer going to go where they are. I'm not going to dash my ship on the rocks seeking out the sirens because I already feel better and I can wave at them. Make sense? That's what we're going to work on together this weekend. Let's keep going. Somebody want to read same person? Because my breath is... Okay, to them... Okay.
The alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented.
When that... Stop 1 second. When they're not eating, they're restless, irritable, and discontented. When I don't eat, I feel like crap when I'm not in recovery. Go on.
Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking. After they have succumbed to a desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
Let's replace psychic change in our mind with spiritual awakening as the result of working the steps. And if I have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, I have lots of hope of a recovery. Keep going.
On the other hand, and this, as strange as this who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seems doomed, who has so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules.
What are the rules? The steps. You're doing great. Keep going.
Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change.
Spiritual awakening. Go on.
Though the aggregate?
Aggregate. Total number.
Recovery resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control.
They didn't want to escape anything. They had a craving which put them beyond their own mental willpower, their own control. You're doing great. Keep going.
There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
Now listen to that for just a second here. How many people, including you who are in this room, and you're very brave to have come here because this is a hard thing to do. You put sort of a bracket around your weekend and you're here, and I know some of you are going back and forth and you're going to bring me grapes and Diet Pepsi tomorrow, and that's great. But the bottom line is you have situation here where there are people like my mother, and she's not alone in this. They're just, they've given up. There's nothing, they have nothing to fight with. There's no arrows left in their quiver. That sun is right in your face. Is there any way we can change it? Okay. All right. Now, if there are people out there making that supreme sacrifice, they just don't have anything to fight with anymore. They've been on every effing diet. They've been to every doctor, and now it's just a matter of death by Dorito. That's just, they're going to go death by Dorito. They don't, and I was in that situation too. I didn't have a gun or want a gun, you know, put it to my head. I'm going death by Dorito, baby. I'm going, you know, I'm going coma by candy. Just leave me alone, and I'm going to do my thing. What a waste that would have been. What a waste that would have been. I would have never seen these mountains. I would have never seen your faces. I would have never said, yes, I've been to Alaska. Yes, I've been to Anchorage, Alaska. And yes, I've been to the retreat center at Holy Cross or Holy Spirit, whatever it is. So, yes. And I've never heard your laughter, and I would have never been here to see your faces. What a waste that would have been for me. If I give you nothing, I'm getting more out of this weekend than I could ever give you. I don't have what you have. Just to see your faces. If I die tonight, I die a happy man, because I was here and I came here and I got to see your faces on Friday night. So they're going to make that supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight, because they don't know that there's any way of not fighting. Just work the damn steps quickly, I promise. You know, I told you the story of when I was in the hospital. I told you that story. If I went back to that same hospital that night, and I went down to the cancer ward, and I talked to the men and women who had terminal cancer in that hospital that night, and I would have said to those men and women, come with me. We're going to go to a meeting down at the Lieberman Center, down Grosse Pointe Road here. We're going to tell other people about how our cancer has affected us. And we're going to hear their stories about how the cancer has affected them. And we're going to confess to a God that we want to turn our will and our life over to His care and His direction. And we're going to confess our defects of character to another person. We're going to list our angers and our fears and our sexual harms done others. And we're going to inventory these things, and then we're going to tell them to another person. Comes from confession, from the steps of the Oxford group. We're going to tell another person the nature of our wrongs, and then we're going to go out and we're going to let God have these defects of character, and then we're going to go about making restitution, making amends to people that we have harmed, and then we're going to continue to enlarge our spiritual life. We're going to ask God for guidance and direction in everything that we do. We're going to turn our defects over to Him. Then we're going to go out and we're going to help other people. And not only will you be cured of your cancer, you will have a life beyond your wildest dreams, free of the cancer and able to help other people. They would have said to me, take me. I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll do it. They would have signed over their houses to me. They would have signed over their cars to me. They would have given me their bank accounts. They would have given me their daughters. Whatever it was that they could have done to attain this remedy, they would have done it. We're standing in front of the world with a remedy for the most vicious addiction. Do you realize that something happened, and I promised I wouldn't go crazy, but I'm going to try to make this quick. In 1995, something happened that is shameful. Something happened that is spitting in the face of everything we've known. Here's what happened. 1995, a generation of Americans were born with a shorter life expectancy than their parents. Now think about that. A shorter life expectancy than their parents. With all we know, why? Because of the pandemic of type 2 juvenile diabetes. That's the reason. Not because of the pollution, not because of whatever, tsunamis or salamis or whatever, not because of that. Because of an epidemic in children of type 2 diabetes. Diabetes today is affecting 8, 9, 10-year-olds at epidemic proportion. You've got 14-year-olds on insulin. Why? The obesity is epidemic. Here's a solution. It's free. It's free. You don't want to drop a buck in the basket? Don't. There's no dues or fees for membership. Do you work out scholarships for people that want to come here? I bet you do. Mm-hmm. I bet we do at our retreats in Arizona.
You want to come badly enough? We will find a spot for you. We'll put you to work. You know, you'll be getting me the grapes and the Diet Pepsi or whatever, but we'll put you to work. But you can have a spot at the retreat, all expenses paid for free. We'll work that out for you.
It's a shanda for the neighbors. You know what that means? It's a shame for the neighbors. Okay, you know where we are at, so you can keep reading.
The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going from the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision.
A decision, we're going to find out later on. Step three is referred to as a beginning and a decision. A beginning and a decision. So what is that decision? To turn your will, which is your thinking, and your life, which is your action, over to God.
There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type, who is, perhaps, the least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are types entirely normal in every aspect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these, and many others, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of thirst.
Once I take a brownie in my mouth, I'm going to eat all the brownies. The only time I ever ate one cookie was when it was the last cookie. Keep going.
This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
Now, this entire abstinence is the second reference to something that gets me in a lot of trouble. It's gotten me in trouble at the in Los Angeles a few times. Put down the food. If you're eating, you are not going to have a spiritual awakening. Please don't attack me when we're... first of all, I got to go to my room and go to sleep when we're done. I'm tired. But the second thing is, don't attack me. That's my opinion. It says it in the book. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. If you're still eating, you're not going to have the spiritual awakening. You're not. Trust me on that one. Okay, go on.
This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed.
Most doctors have absolutely no respect for anything that pretends to cure this or curb it. Even my cardiologist and my physician, more my cardiologist, I have AFib, unfortunately, but he is of that opinion where he just shrugs his shoulders. He said to me one time, you're one in 20 million. He said, you are one in 20 million that I've seen. He says, most of these people that I have coming in here, he's a cardiologist. Come on, man, if that doesn't wake you up, nothing's gonna. My hand hurts right. Anyway, he says, these people come in here and they cry and I this and they're heavier every single time they come in. And their diabetes is worse every time they come in. And their heart is worse every time they come in. And their blood pressure is worse every time they come in. Mine stays the same. Mine responds to the medication and stays fine. You know, I'm getting older, obviously, you know, and, you know, I'm 58. I'm not, you know, 7 anymore. But, you know, all right, anyway, go on.
What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted in belief that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all the resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time had passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own
diagnosis
and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and, in desperate condition, brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect.
This letter is about Hank Parkhurst. This is the one letter that is not about Bill. This part is about Hank P. And they weren't sure what they could do for him. He was a very, very hopeless person. And Hank P. proved to be one of the first, or the first, real success stories of the New York groups. Dr. Bob was a far more successful sponsor than Bill. Most of the early successes came out of Akron. They did not come out of New York. Bob was a much more successful sponsor. So if you look at the pioneer section of the big book in the back, most of those stories were people coming from Akron. If you read the book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which is conference approved, a lot of those, or all those stories are about the Akron groups, Cleveland groups. And Bill was not as good a sponsor. You had him, we had Hank, and you had Marty Mann, and you had Jim Burrell and Fitz. You had a couple of them coming out of there that were recovering, but Dr. Bob's numbers were far better. So anyway, go on.
However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray.
Mm-hmm. William D. Silkworth, M.D. Okay, tomorrow we're going to cover Bill's story, and we're going to cover Chapter 5 and some of Chapter 6. Tomorrow, what I want to do is make Bill's story a lot less about Bill and a lot more about you, so that you can relate to it in a much better way. Maybe you'll see some things maybe that you hadn't seen before. And then tomorrow in the second session, we're going to smash through steps 3 and 4, and we're going to demystify them. We're going to make it so that they will no longer be misunderstood. And I promise you this, I am going to do everything I can do to lay out step 4 so simply that you'll wonder what you were ever thinking in the past on it. So let's get a good night's sleep, and we'll come back tomorrow at 9 a.m.